Got it? Something's working. Is it working?
Oh, yes, it's working.
Oh, good.
It's just that I can't see it.
I think this is working too.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it's working now. So let's just... Okay. There we go. There we go. Now, I think we have to be kind of close to that, so let's keep... Okay, so what I'll do is I'll identify myself for the tape, and you can identify yourself for the tape.
Okay.
And today is the 2nd of February, 2008, and I'm in the home of Mr. Peirce, who was a member of the Grenadier Guards during World War II and captured at Hong Kong. And we are going to do an interview for Ian Fenningworth with respect to his time in captivity, and especially as related to a Sergeant Lieutenant Commander Stenning. So, help yourself.
Well, I'm Ross Peirce.
You're Ross Peirce.
And you're in my home in Nanaimo, and I'm delighted to meet you, John.
And I'm delighted to meet you, sir.
And look forward to the interview.
Thank you. The first question is, take as long or as short as you wish. We've got lots of time. Your regiment going to Hong Kong, and what sorts of role, what was your responsibilities within the regiment preparing to defend Hong Kong?
Well, in the beginning I was just an ordinary soldier, but then I joined the band, and I played clarinet in the military band for the Winnipeg Grenadiers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined the force because my brother, who was a sort of semi-permanent in the Hong Kong group in Manitoba, and he and I joined the force at the same time on my birthday, September the 10th.
Yeah, and what year?
1939.
That's right, yeah.
Well,
yeah. So how come you... Well, keep on, and you're a good storyteller. Just keep on describing your life in the regiment and then going to Hong Kong and that sort of thing.
Well, in the beginning, as I said, I was just an ordinary soldier. And then they formed the band, and I became part of the military band and enjoyed the association with the other musicians. And during that period, we did a lot of marching and, of course, displays and entertainment in Winnipeg. And then we were shipped out to Jamaica, where we were looking after an internment camp, primarily of Germans. And in that area, we also put on concerts, and we had a dance band along with the military band, and we played for a number of concerts, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really quite an enjoyable group to get together with, and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then, when did your regiment leave for Hong Kong?
Well, we were down in Jamaica for about a year, a little over a year, and then we came back home and exchanged our uniforms from tropical to sort of a standard military uniform. None of us knew where we were going because they wouldn't give you the information. And so, during the period we were in Winnipeg, we exchanged, I said, our uniforms, and we also got acquainted with some of our old friends that we had met before the war, and got ourselves ready to depart. And we were to board the Awatea, which was a New Zealand ship, very nice ship. It carried 600 passengers, 1,200 airmen, or 2,000 soldiers. So that told you something about how crowded we were.
Yeah.
We, as I said, we got ourselves ready, said goodbye to our families, etc., and we sailed from Vancouver in the early part of December. I guess maybe it was November. I've just forgotten the date we sailed. But we also found out after we were at sea, and they announced where we're going, that we lost about 40 of our members who deserted at the park. And so we do nothing about that. They had already escaped by jumping out through the park holes. And so we're about 12 hours at sea when they announced we're going to Hong Kong. And so from there on in, the crowded conditions, we settled in with that. Some of us had to sleep on deck.
Yeah.
They had to put some of them on the destroyer that we were, that accompanied us.
Uh-huh.
And so we're finally on our way.
Uh-huh. And when you landed in Hong Kong, did you do any training in preparation for defending it?
You mean when we arrived?
Yeah.
Well, when we arrived, we were housed in a military camp.
Mm-hmm.
Camp Chapeau it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very nice camp. One thing I couldn't get used to was the various batmen.
Oh, yeah.
They would shave you while you're sleeping.
I'll be honest.
And I didn't enjoy waking up seeing a straight razor.
No.
But anyway, that's where we were kept until, well, just before the war started. They then started moving us out onto the island of Hong Kong and showing us the different positions that we were to defend.
Yeah.
But there was really very little defense because our military had not, equipment had not arrived, and there we were with rifles and rifles only.
Only rifles?
Yeah, pretty well.
Yeah.
And the British troops that were there were not very well supplied either. And so we took up our positions, and I was in Wan Chai Gap, which was a water reservoir area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty well what we had to do, and of course we tried desperately to defend the island, but it was impossible.
Yeah.
I think they estimated there were about 80,000 troops against us.
Yeah.
And they had sea vessels that were very able to bomb the island. The aircraft, we didn't have any aircraft, but we had three, but they never left the ground in Kaitak.
Oh, golly.
They were just dropping.
Yeah.
And the two ships we had, I think they picked up all the gold from the banks and that, and they headed for Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
But so we had no defense from sea, from the air, and we were simply sitting ducks.
Yeah.
And
excuse me, dear.
One of the
things. Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you.
Good to meet you.
Sorry about our house.
No, I understand you're moving to.
We're taping.
Yes.
We're taping.
It's okay. We can. The tape doesn't care.
What do you like in your coffee?
I'll just have it black, please.
That's all I wanted to know.
Okay, thank you.
And and so the situation became very grim.
Yeah.
One of the things we found out was that prior to the attack, the Japanese or the Orientals were moving caskets from the mainland onto the island. And we, of course, they're very well protected, never inspected a casket. What they were bringing across for arms, we didn't know this. And they're going up into the hills, into the Chinese cemetery, and they'd bury them.
Yeah.
Well, then we found out that there's a lot of priests up there working, signaling.
Oh, yeah.
And they were signaling to the troops. Then they were working on the graves at all. Oh. And so, really, we were at a very serious disadvantage. We did what we could, but we lost heavily in the few days that the war started.
Yeah.
And I think if the Japanese had really learned how to conquer the island, they could have done it with less people being injured and killed. But they tried to come in from the front, and that's the only defense we had. But once they landed, our intelligence told us not to worry. There's only about 20 or 30 soldiers that had landed, and they headed for the hills. But what we didn't know at the time was they headed for the hills and picked up their armament that was in the cemetery. And so we started getting fired from the back also.
Oh, my.
And it wasn't long before, you know, we were in a very desperate situation. I wasn't captured. I had to surrender because, quite frankly, our troops were really separated in terms of military force. And as you may know,
you were a few here and a few there.
Yeah. And as you may know, our Sergeant Major Osborne,
yeah,
he won the Victoria Cross for his gallantry.
Yeah.
But the, quite frankly, the defense of Hong Kong by the Winnipeg Grenadiers and the Royal Rifles,
yeah,
was outstanding.
Yeah.
As I say, we lost heavily.
Yeah.
And but eventually we were taken prisoner.
Yeah. After capture, you surrendered rather than,
yeah,
captured. And you were taken to a compound and then transported.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Well, they dropped leaflets saying if you didn't surrender by sundown,
uh-huh,
you'd be shot on sight.
Uh-huh.
And so myself and two others that I am from our company, we commandeered a little Volkswagen, and we started to report to what was called Happy Valley.
Uh-huh.
I never understood that. That was a race course,
yeah,
in Hong Kong. And so we had to stack our arms. We had no defense on, no military presence at all. And we finally met the enemy. And it was quite an experience because they'd all been drinking.
Yeah.
And the treatment was just unbelievable, how they tried to aggravate you. Took any pictures you had from your wallets and that, peed on them,
yeah,
stamped them into the earth. And did all sorts of things to really try and create a problem for you. From there, we eventually got a little bit of protection from some of the officers that arrived. And that evening, we went up to what they called the peak, where they was the our battalion headquarters. We got up to the peak and in the late evening, and we were then recorded as to who we were and our regimental number, etc. And we spent the night there, along with some sparingly, some food was distributed. And then the next day, we started marching down to a point that we call North Point. It's a little camp that was made up primarily for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the sad part of that was that you were either wired together or roped together, and some of the people that were very seriously wounded couldn't make it. They just,
yeah,
collapsed, and of course they just shot them up there. Every once in a while they take you out and line you up, and they'd line you up and as if they're going to mow you down with a machine gun. Get on here, come on. Get. And then they'd pull off that fire and put you back in the ranks again and start you marching. But we finally arrived in North Point, and we were put into groups. The officers had one set of their huts. And the hut I was in only contained six people. And
get out of here. Come on. Come. Only can house six people.
And the people that were with me were non-medical people, but I was at that time an orderly in the hospital. And so the...
this was still in Hong Kong.
This is still in Hong Kong, North Point.
North Point, yeah.
And after about a year in North Point, and where I worked in the hospital there with the doctors, they then moved us over to Sham Shui Po. And in Sham Shui Po, the camp, of course, had been seriously damaged by bombing. They had a lot of dead Chinese laying around the area, but we finally got them cleaned up, and then they wired electric wire all around the camp. And that was a sort of a disturbing situation because they would take Chinese off the street. No reason at all. Sit him in a chair, open up his shirt, throw in cigarettes all day.
Mm.
And every once in a while, jab him with a bayonet in the evening, they kill him.
Mm.
And then they would take our guys that they had determined were misbehaving, and they'd put them at the far end of the electrical fence, which was very acres.
Mm.
And they'd tie them on there, and then they'd show them throwing the switch. Electricity going around, bang. And it was extremely a cruel experience. And then I used to watch the Chinese ladies bringing material to the camp for the Chinese that had been captured with us.
Yeah.
And they'd get maybe 50 feet, 100 feet from the gate. The Japanese would open fire and kill a few of them. They'd take refuge behind the buildings. As soon as firing stopped, they'd come back out, pick up their parcels, come right back to the gate. Unbelievable people. And that went on, you know, pretty well all the time we were there. And then the other most serious problem I saw was when they would pick a pregnant lady, they'd pick her up, bring her to the gate, tie her down, tap her in the stomach until she aborted the baby. And then they just baited her. Very cruel, very sadistic people. But in the camp itself, we were, given the meager food, rice and fish on occasion. But the diet kept dropping down, the volume kept dropping down, the calories weren't there.
Yeah.
And the only work we had to do, though, at the time was cut the grass at Kai Tak Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And we also had to lower the mountains by 18 inches. So go up on top and take them. And so finally they decided they'd move us to Japan. And so they said anybody that can go on parade will be eligible to go to Japan. So my brother and I thought, well, it maybe be better there than here. And so we volunteered. And we went on parade, and finally we were picked to go to Japan. And we were about the second ship, I guess, or third ship. And there were nothing but things that had been brought up from the bottom of the sea, I think.
Yeah.
They were coal ships, and they had been sunk or just pretty well damaged. And they used it as trailers. The Japanese would send their fleet with all kinds of materials that they wanted in Japan, and leave us at the trailer. And some of the trailers were, of course, sunk by submarine, American
mm-hmm.
submarine. They didn't know who was on those ships.
Yeah.
And we were 18 days going from Hong Kong in a coal ship that was one time used for barging coal. We were down the hold of the ship. Didn't have room to lay down or sit down.
Thank you so very much. It's very, very kind of you.
Not mine.
I can't carry two of them on the stairs.
One at a time.
So all you could do was sit in a squat position.
Yeah.
And that's where you stayed for 18 days. They had metal buckets, so they lowered the food, which is nothing but fish bones, etc. And they lowered these metal buckets again for your toilet. And I was never sure which bucket was which.
Which was which, oh my.
But eventually we arrived in Japan, and we arrived at in Osaka. We arrived in Hong Kong, in Tokyo.
Yeah.
And we spent the night there under heavy bombing that was taking place. Then the next day we went by train down to Osaka. And from there we went by train over to Oyama.
And what year was it that you got to Tokyo?
I guess it would be 43.
About 43 then, eh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Because I was 2 years in Oyama.
So you were 2 years in Oyama, and so that The surrender took place in 1941. So you spent quite a bit of time.
Christmas Day.
Yeah, but you spent quite a bit of time in Hong Kong before you were transferred.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That would be about.
Just about under the 2 years.
Under 2 years in Hong Kong.
In North Point and Sam Chapeau.
I see. Okay.
And so.
Oh my, not only that, we get num-nums.
Just a couple.
Oh, excellent.
This is John, Vivian.
Yes.
Good to meet you.
We spoke on the phone.
Yeah.
Oh, did you?
There you are.
Thanks again.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you. Yes, we, just under the 2 years in Hong Kong, and then approximately 2 years in Japan.
Yeah. Could I ask, it was in Hong Kong that you got involved in hospital work and caring for others? Was that where that started?
Yes.
And how come that started? I mean, was it just a natural...
Well, two things. One, I always had an interest in it, but furthermore, in the band, some of the band people took up the orderly training under the doctorate.
Oh, yeah?
And I did that there.
Oh, I see.
And then... when we got into the very serious diphtheria situation in Sam Chapeau, I worked at night in the hospital and generally carried anything up to seven people a night that died.
Oh boy.
Just strangled themselves.
Yeah.
And then I developed the condition myself, and the doctor said, well, you know, it's not really timely to give them the injection which they had just received.
Yeah.
But because I'd worked so much with the patients, they did inject me, and I think maybe that saved my life.
I'll be darned. Thank you.
And that's where I worked with Dr. I think of his name, John Crawford.
Oh.
I worked with Dr. John Crawford throughout that period of time, and Dr. Gray and others that were in the regiment with us.
They were Canadians?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And then, as I say, I worked all that period in the so-called hospital, which is a cement floor, in the diphtheria crises, and but I was able to go to Japan with my brother.
And when you got to Japan, I mean, the conditions in Hong Kong, as you described, were gee whiz.
Yeah.
And then when you got to the new camp in, not new, I guess, but the camp in Oyama, what sorts of differences were there there?
Well, two things. I think, one, the military camp that we had in Hong Kong was a former military camp.
Mm-hmm.
We got to Oyama, it was a new unit that was set up just for us. And so there was no military presence, I'm talking about barracks or anything like that. We just simply were put into huts as we were in the North Point. But Sam Chapeau was a military camp. So the difference was really that we now found ourselves in a strictly prison camp.
And did they... did the discipline stay the same, harsh discipline? Did it change, or did it become more systematic, or become more regulated, or could you deal with it better?
In Sam Chapeau, we received some very serious beatings by the young guy that was the interpreter from Canada, and he would deliver the blows and the serious problems that we faced just for no particular reason other than for his sadistic satisfaction.
And he was a Canadian and and got into...
He was a Kamloops. We call him a Kamloops kid.
Oh, God.
And so from a workforce, it was not as bad in Hong Kong. But the physical abuse was pretty serious. But when we got to... up to Oyama, then we got working in the mines, and that was a very serious assignment.
Yeah,
the conditions were pretty bad in the sense that you were underfed, certainly underclothed, and the mining was surface mining of the coal like we have here today.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to take into account that most of our guards were people that had been wounded or seriously injured during the war, so they became our guards now,
yeah.
And they didn't have much sympathy for us.
Oh.
And in the in Oyamas where I worked in the mines as an orderly, caring for the troops that were injured at work.
Down in the mine?
Well, they were surface mines.
Oh, I see. They didn't go down a hole.
No.
You went over like a...
Just on the side of a mountain.
I see.
And the sad part of it was that we would be loaded into these cattle cars at about, 6, 7 in the morning, and the train in very cold weather, all the slats on the cars, you know, and they lined the kids up in the schools to throw rocks at us as we went by.
Yeah.
And then when we arrived there, we were simply brought in by coal cars and that were in the mine for working there, and we loaded these cars and sent them down to the hoppers, and that's what we did all day.
Yeah.
And it wasn't uncommon to have so many injuries that they just couldn't handle it. We had these picks that were about 10 feet long in the handle, and you had to wave them across your head and throw them into the face of the mine to bring down the stuff. And if you didn't produce so much a day, you just got a beating for it.
Yeah.
And in the evening, then you had to clean up all your tools, and if they found any dirt on them, again, another beating. So we did one thing that was really helpful to us. We would, when anybody was hurt, I'd have to go down to the guardhouse with a couple others, go to the guardhouse, take off your hat, bow, and to be sitting there reading the paper. And the papers were little wee magazine types. And they'd jump up when I tell them somebody'd been hurt. They'd rush out, our guys would pick up the papers, put them under the hats, and we back the camp. And the interesting part was when you took the person into the camp from the mine, they searched you, but they never searched him or for the injured person.
I see.
So we were able to take the stuff right in into the camp, and then our people got practice reading the characters and pretty soon could determine pretty well what was happening.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of thoughts on my mind is during this time, so there's really a sort of phase-wise, there's your time in the regiment before the surrender, and then there was the surrender in which you stayed almost 2 years or thereabouts in a couple of camps in on Hong Kong Island.
Yeah.
And
only one on the island, North Point.
North Point, yeah, only one on the island, right. And then to Tokyo, and then you went up to the mines, Oyama. And whereabouts was Oyama Tokyo, kind of?
You can sort of pinpointed it right across from Vladivostok.
Yeah, right.
And so we were on the water and almost directly across from there.
I see.
Right across the island from Osaka.
I see. Okay, now I got it. And the guards in Hong Kong were ordinary soldiers, I think, is that right?
They were which?
The guards were ordinary soldiers?
Ordinary soldiers that have been wounded during the...
So they were, and then over in Oyama, they were still wounded soldiers.
Yeah.
But the treatment, by and large, was pretty much the same?
Yes, it was, except that the work ethics was so severe in comparison.
In comparison.
And your temperature, you see, in Hong Kong, the temperature was pretty mild.
Yeah.
And, but in, got up into Oyama.
Cold in the wintertime.
We got winter, just like this here.
Yeah.
It would be a lot of snow and very cold, wet weather.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we had to, work on that. There was nothing to dry your clothes out with.
Yeah.
You put them under your blanket or whatever you had to sleep on the tatami and hope that it would be a little bit drier in the morning.
Yeah. And one of the questions here is I guess one of the questions that are on my mind is that you started off with so many people, let's say you had 500 grenadiers or so, and then there were losses in Hong Kong, and there were losses on the way over, and the losses there. Did other captured soldiers from elsewhere come into your camp? For
we had Americans, we had British, and we had one or two Russians. But it was primarily made up of Canadians and Americans.
And the Americans came from any idea where they had served, where they had been captured?
Well, a lot of them had been captured down in Singapore.
Oh, I see.
Or at sea. And the British, of course, were in Hong Kong with us.
Yeah. And the get-along factor was pretty good between all of you.
Yeah, I'd say that. There was a noticeable difference. The Americans to Canadians was good. The Americans to the British was less favorable. They had seemed to assimilate with us a lot better.
Yeah, well, that's understandable. Coming from North America, the culture is pretty much the same. You go, you know, wherever you go, much more pioneering, perhaps. The last parts here, I think, probably is where Ian would like to have some lasting impressions of Sergeant Lieutenant Commander Stenning, and how you got to know him, and how did he arrange to take over discipline, or anything else you can remember about him.
Well, there were two doctors in the camp, Dr. Stenning, Dr. Beadnell.
Yeah, that's the fellow who wrote your letter.
And again, apparently Dr. Stenning also wrote a letter of commendation, but I know nothing about it. So
okay.
He worked in what we'd almost call the emergency ward. We had a hut that was taking care of the people right beside what they called their medical center.
Yeah.
That's where Harvey and Tugby lived, at the one end of that hut. They had a great time.
Yeah.
Music, women, everything.
Yeah.
And our people were simply laid out on the tamics, or the area where we had given them the blanket, and that was about all. And Dr. Stenning, I felt so sorry for them. The doctors were so sympathetic and so had so much compassion.
Yeah.
And so I worked with them in the sense that the gangrene set in, it was very bad.
Yeah.
And the hands and the feet, the toes.
Yeah.
And they used to say to me, well, you can remove that toe or that finger.
Yeah.
And all we had is afterflavian, which is a disinfectant. Remove the finger, stop the increase of the condition, and then wrap it real tight. And that's what we did to get by with the limited. There's really no resources at all.
Yeah.
But the doctors were, and Stenning was one of the best. He certainly never showed any rank. Always with the fellows.
And he was a Canadian.
Yep.
And
well, he wasn't. I think he's a New Zealander, but he spent a lot of time in Canada.
Oh, I see. But his place of birth and raising was in,
I think it's New Zealand or Australia.
One or the other. Yeah. It's a bit of an. I don't know how it was back in the regiment in your days, but it's a bit of an anomaly in a Canadian regiment for a doctor to take command. And the question that Ian is asking, that was there nobody more senior than Sergeant Lieutenant Commander Stenning?
Not that I know of.
And so he was the senior officer present.
Oh, yes.
And so he had, as I understand it, he took the position as the senior officer in the camp.
Well, as far as we knew, you didn't always have that information, but it looked that way, yes.
From the way you saw him behave, mm-hmm. and the way other people responded to him.
The other people that took over and pretty well shut the others out was Tugby and the other guy. I never thought I'd forget his name.
He'll come to you.
But Tugby was a Canadian, and Harvey was an Englishman, and they just really became fluent in the Japanese language, and they simply paraded with the Japanese camp commander at all times. So they became the authority in the sense that the Japanese listened to them.
They were probably not too well thought of. These guys. So that would be a, I agree with you, they're not too well thought of.
No.
Oh, no. But Sergeant Lieutenant Commander Stenning, he didn't do that then.
He didn't wish?
He did not parade with the Japanese.
Oh, no, he was our friend.
He was your guy.
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting.
Dr. Beadnell and Stenning, and Dr. Crawford, who was the senior officer, medical officer in Shamsapol, mm-hmm. they were all very supportive of the men, and they would stand up and defy the Japanese, mm-hmm. and take the punishment.
But the other guys didn't.
Yep. But Tugby and Harvey, they were just completely committed to the Japanese authority, and we suffered the consequences.
Yeah, I know this is just an aside, but when I interviewed German fellow about his time in Russia, and we got fairly friendly. As a matter of fact, he became a family friend. But he came, this issue of loyalty or standing up for what's right, whatever. Yeah. He said the worst thing there was, he said the beatings were bad, you were always being beaten. But he said, in our mind, the worst thing was to see those who you had trusted go the other way. He said that really hurt, where you can't put bandages.
No, it is unbelievable that, like, take for example Tugby, who I knew very well.
Yeah.
And to see him all often smash you just as a part of the routine.
He would do as part of the...
Oh, yeah. One of the things that you had to do if you're going to survive, you had to really defy them and not lose face. On one occasion, for example, they used to treat the men with what's called a moka weed. It's like a burnt, the ash of a cigarette, lit cigarette.
Yeah.
And they put it on spots, and it had to be 1, 3, or 5 times, they had to be 1, 3, or it had to be 3, 5, or 7, not one, on the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our guys couldn't do this. They just blistered in the pain. So in my hut, which I was a group leader, I had about 4 or 5 patients who were quite ill, and they were supposed to take the moka weed treatment. When they came in to see what I had done, I said, "I'm sorry, but I'm not able to carry out your orders because the men can't tolerate it." With that, Harvey and Tugby, in support of the Japanese, beat the hell out of me. When I became conscious, again, I decided I better do something. I got up from the tatami and I went over to the medical center because I was badly bruised, and because they hit you with always the back of it. So I went over and I said that I needed treatment, and I had a broken rib. So the Japanese looked at me And I said, I want treatment. So they gave me what treatment they had, wiped out the wounds and whatnot. After that, they never touched me.
I'll be darned.
No.
So you stood up and
well, it's the only way you could survive if you... I didn't do it consciously. I think I did it unconsciously.
But you did do, instinctively.
Yeah.
You did, yeah.
And it certainly made it easier for me there on in. But that didn't change Harvey or Tugby's treatment toward me. But I had such much admiration for Beadle and Stenning that these guys must have torn their heart out, you know, being medical people.
Yeah.
Nothing to treat the guys with.
Yeah.
And just see a guy come in and he'd say, I've had enough. And as Dr. Stenning would say, and he'll die.
Yeah.
Within 48 hours, he was dead.
Yeah.
Just give up.
Yeah, if you give up in your head, then...
And so then we we prepare the body and tie off all the areas that had to be tied off. And they come in with these motorcycles with a wooden casket as a sidecar. And that's where the body would put in. And then two of us would sit on the lid of the of those wooden bars. Well, the motorcycle went up to the crematorium.
Yeah.
And I tell you, we took a long time pushing that body in.
I suppose.
The only time we got warm.
Oh, golly. Oh, my. Oh, my, 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 my.
You know, really, to explain it, I wouldn't treat an animal the way they treated us. I just wouldn't do that. I think in a way we're lucky that a lot of it didn't register because we were so poorly nourished and so sick at heart.
Yeah.
You know, you just you reach a point where, so what the hell?
Yeah. And throughout all this, getting back a little bit to Sergeant Lieutenant Commander Stenning, you did what you could as a hospital orderly and those sorts of things, and you got well acquainted with him, and he was a stand-up true heart.
He was just like Beadle Lane or Crawford. These were outstanding medical people.
Yeah.
I would never have known he was a lieutenant commander.
Yeah.
He was just Dr. So-and-so.
Yeah.
But they were outstanding people.
Yeah. I think we're coming pretty much to a conclusion here. Perhaps a little bit of a description of things that went on. See, I don't know. Did Commander Stenning last the war? Did he survive the war?
As far as I know.
Uh-huh.
As far as I know.
But you never saw him again?
No, you see, we were shipped out to Canada.
Uh-huh.
And I think he's Australian. I've just forgotten what happened to him. Beadle came back to Canada for the war trials.
Uh-huh.
And I saw Dr. Beadle once after that. But, you know, just imagine, for example, you know these big graders for the gravel on the highway?
Yeah.
They take about 60 or 70 or 80 of us with a long rope.
Yeah.
We had to pull those graders so they could...
Grade the road.
Grade the road.
I'll be damned.
You have to understand, too, that we were so paralyzed from the cold and malnutrition, we couldn't undo our pants to
do anything.
Do anything. And therefore, you know, it was, well, again with the edema.
Yeah.
If you fell off your pillow, they'd take a bucket of water off my side every other day.
Mm-hmm.
And fell off my pillow once, and my face was just a balloon. And what would happen? You would choke to death.
Yeah.
The water would work up.
Yeah.
And then you're filled with these round worms.
Yeah.
These round worms in your stomach come up.
Oh, God.
Just awful.
Just awful.
And how you survived, I'll never know.
It's absolutely amazing. The tale that you tell me right now, I just, it's, you know, every time I've interviewed a prisoner of war, there's always these stories, and I just don't know how in the world you folks did it.
Quite frankly, you know, I'm not a brave person. And I'm not, I'm a survivor maybe, but don't honestly believe, but when I tell you, it's hard for me to believe it truly happened.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now that it's so, yeah. But
well, it's when I think about going through that.
Yeah.
I think about when I burnt the sole of my shoes, and in weather like this, just your shorts.